Welcome to Warpod, a podcast brought to you by Safer World, asking experts from around the world about the impact of security policy on contemporary conflict. I'm Charlie Linney, Project Coordinator in the Arms Unit at Safer World. And today, I'm also joined by my colleague Jordan Street, who is Senior Policy and Advocacy Lead at Safer World USA. In this episode, we're exploring developments in peacekeeping, looking back at lessons from past missions and thinking about the future of peacekeeping operations. To help us do this, we speak to three experts with very different perspectives on peacekeeping. First, we chat to Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, who represents California's 51st Congressional District and is a ranking member in the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa in the US government. Next, we speak to two guests, David Hayeri from the United Nations Department of Peace Operations, who leads a division responsible for policy evaluation and training issues. We also speak to Dr. Linda Darkwer, who is a senior research fellow at the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy at the University of Ghana. She's also the coordinator for the Training for Peace program, where she works with the African Union Commission. Now, before we get into the episode, there's a lot to unpack here. When we're speaking broadly about peace operations, this at the UN includes peacekeeping operations and special political missions. Traditional peacekeeping operations, or missions, are intended to preserve an existing peace or support early stage peace processes. Then we have the concept of peace enforcement, which the UN Secretary General formally introduced and gave extra weight to in his new Agenda for Peace policy brief, which was launched in July 2023. Peace enforcement is completely different from peacekeeping because it involves the use of force against combatants and has typically supported or used counter-terrorism type tactics. 2023 was a really important year for the future of peacekeeping discussion. We saw major UN peacekeeping missions in Mali and DRC being asked to leave, and in early 2024, we saw the same thing in Sudan. As a result, the ability of the UN to respond to violent conflict through peacekeeping is really being called into question. Alongside this, in December 2023, we saw the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2719, which enhances collaboration between the United Nations and the African Union on peace operations. This, for the first time, authorizes funding from the UN regular budget to directly resource African Union-led peace operations. But what does all of this mean for the UN and the AU as institutions? How is peacekeeping going to change in the next year and in the coming decades? So, to begin the episode, Jordan and I speak to Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs. The United States is the biggest financial contributor to UN peacekeeping operations, so she tells us about how issues related to peacekeeping come across her desk. Welcome, Congresswoman. So, we know that you recently held a hearing in the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa about the future of peacekeeping. Why did you feel it was important to raise peacekeeping in this context?
You know, I used to work at the UN in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, so I know how important peacekeeping missions can be and the really important role they play. And lots of research has shown that they are more effective at ending conflict and are a better investment for the price than any of the alternatives. At the same time, we also know that they might not be the only tool that we need to use. And there are a lot of lessons we can learn from how peacekeeping has engaged in some of these conflicts around the world and some of the challenges and opportunities that there are in peacekeeping. And so I thought this was a really important time to really think about the future of peacekeeping, especially as the UN recently adopted a resolution allowing UN-assessed funds to be used for AU peace support operations.
So the new UN Security Council resolution that you mentioned now actually allows funding for AU peace support operations directly. Previously, this had to be funded directly by individual donors. So this is quite a big deal for the future of peacekeeping. But some would argue that this is only happening because there's a growing concern that UN peacekeepers are being asked to operate in conflict contexts where it's increasingly challenging because there's presence of violent groups using terror tactics. So this dynamic has seen the UN Secretary General champion this idea of peace enforcement, despite some reticence from parts of the UN system. Now, what concerns do you have, if any, about this shift? And what do you think the United States should do to engage on this?
I think it's really important for us to recognize where and when peacekeeping missions make sense and when, where and when it might make sense to use a different kind of tool. So, for example, we know that UN peacekeeping missions aren't necessarily always the right fit in places where, quote unquote, there's no peace to keep or where there are high levels of violent extremism. But, you know, it's important that whatever the tool we're using, we need to step back and recognize that the root causes of conflict are almost never actually solved with a military-only solution. And we know that, for instance, human rights violations and security sector, you know, security abuse that's being done by militaries and police services against civilians, those are one of the biggest drivers of violent extremism. And so whether it's a peacekeeping mission, whether it's a peace support operation from the AU, whether it's something else, we need to be cognizant that at the end of the day, these really all require political solutions, and that if these military operations are not nested under a political solution, they're at the end of the day not going to be successful.
That's a really great point, Congresswoman. Safe World's peacebuilding program and research has shown that military solutions alone cannot achieve political objectives. So that certainly resonates with lots of our experiences. With this in mind, what are the key priorities as you see them for the United States in terms of responding to conflicts in the future?
I think for a long time, the US and the international community has had an over-militarized approach to how we engage with peace and conflict around the world. And we know that that hasn't been successful. And we know that often the main drivers of violent extremism are human rights abuses and security sector abuses by militaries, by police. And so I'm really focused on making sure we are understanding that and changing how we engage in peace and conflict around the world.
Thank you, Congresswoman Jacobs. That was really interesting and great to hear the perspective of someone who works on these issues day to day in a national government. Now we turn to David Hayeri, who works in the UN Department of Peace Operations, and to Linda Darkwa, who focuses on international affairs and diplomacy at the University of Ghana. We speak to them about the evolving role of the United Nations and African Union in peace operations, looking back at lessons from previous missions, looking at current developments in peacekeeping, and thinking ahead to the future.
So, David, we know that your team at the UN has been looking at the implications for the future of peacekeeping, and we at Safe World have collaborated with you on some of this research. Would you be able to tell us about this project and what you see as the big picture challenges for peacekeeping today and beyond?
I think it's important, really, for all parts of the multilateral system at the moment to be thinking about what the future will bring, because there's such a lot of change currently, a changing geopolitical order, the post-Cold War dynamics are changing, divisions in the Security Council, divisions amongst major powers. And so it's important, I think, to be looking ahead and not assuming that what worked previously will work now. And I think that was what spurred us on to engage in this Future of Peacekeeping Operations project. And as you said, we spoke with academics, member states, etc. Some of the major points that came out of it, obviously the multipolarity in the world, which I mentioned, but also a changing nature of conflict, that we saw fragmented conflict actors making it harder to reach durable political solutions, a lack of a political path to resolution of conflict in many cases, so conflicts lasting longer. And yet also, let's say, a kind of democratization of access to technology. So conflict actors beginning to bring new technologies into the conflict space, hybrid warfare, cyber technologies obviously looming on the horizon. And at the same time, we were doing this sort of post-COVID-19, so a keen sense that income inequality and inequalities were also an important part of a picture, a turn towards protectionism, nativism, and accompanying that sort of fiscal belt tightening. So this is the context that we saw. And in that, we had a number of questions as to how we might manage the tension between state-based solutions and more people-centered approaches, the question of whether or not the international community could reach consensus and in what sort of cases it could, the need for the UN to continue to strengthen and indeed widen the partnerships, a clear sense that no one organization or actor has all of the capabilities needed to address these conflicts. And so the importance of working with regional and sub-regional organizations, and of course, development actors, and civil society in the private sector. So kind of a complexity of actors, which I should say all of these things, of course, didn't happen overnight. So, for example, if you look at the last 20 years of peacekeeping, you'll certainly see a continuous rise in the number of actors involved in any conflict situation, any post-conflict situation, a continuous rise in the complexity of interactions between the UN and regional and sub-regional organizations. But that definitely was a trend that we saw continuing. And then, of course, looking a bit more directly at the UN, what adjustments we might need to support and budgeting arrangements so that we can more seamlessly move from different types of mission engagements, peacekeeping, special political missions, situations where no mission could be agreed on. So what budgeting tools might be required, what uniformed and civilian capabilities might be needed for future conflicts to address some of these emerging trends, for example, in the data analytics field and in other areas. And what expertise and tools do we need to incubate to be sure that we are able to respond in a nimble, flexible, and agile way in such an uncertain environment?
So, Linda, I wanted to turn to you. Where does the African Union fit into this future of peacekeeping conversation? I'm thinking about this in particular in light of the UN Security Council Resolution 2719, which was adopted in December 2023, and which opens up the possibility of UN regular budget funding for African-led peace operations.
I don't think that we will see a lot of changes in the African Union's peacekeeping, or rather peace enforcement roles going forward. And this is primarily because the African Union has always deployed into places where the United Nations has not been able to deploy into. So because of its constitutive structure, the African Union is able to deploy into places where there is still active violence, which is something that the UN is constrained to do. And so if we take the example of Somalia, if we take the example of Mali, if we take the example of Darfur, where the African Union partnered the United Nations, you'd realize that these were places where the United Nations could not deploy because they were not peacekeeping in that strict sense. But I need to also be quick to mention that the African Union, like the United Nations, also need consent to be able to deploy. There are only a few instances where the African Union is able to deploy without consent. And these are in instances of genocide, when there is, we've got war crimes or crimes against humanity. So with the examples that I mentioned, you realize that in all of those, even though there were enforcement actions, there was also consent. In the one instance when the African Union tried to deploy without consent, which was in Burundi, it didn't happen. So I think that it's important that we bear this in mind, that we're not going to see this dramatic change overnight because the AU has already been doing enforcement actions and it is not going to be able to deploy without consent in instances that do not fall under these categories. What I think we can expect to change, however, is the effectiveness and the efficiency of African Union peace operations following the resolution that was agreed upon in December. And this is because the African Union has in the past been doing quite well with very little.
Thanks, Linda. So you really clearly summarized the institutional experience and some of the challenges that the African Union has encountered. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about some of the areas where the African Union has been deployed in the past and share some insights on how that's gone?
In Somalia, for example, it did receive considerable support from the United Nations and other bilateral partners. In Darfur, it did receive a lot of support from the United Nations. Now that we have predictability and hopefully flexibility in funding as well, then the African Union will be able to get the required resources. So some of the things that David mentioned, we need to be able to get agile and nimble responses. And those come when you have the right resources. What I need to say, however, is that there will also have to be minimal interference in the operations of the African Union by the United Nations. So we need to have a very fine and delicate balance. If the Security Council deems it right to fund African-led peace operations, then I think that it's also important that they trust the agency of these institutions to which resources are being given. And on the side of the African Union, there are a number of things that need to be done. It cannot be expected that the United Nations provides the funding but does not demand accountability. And I think that David will agree with me that there are a number of processes that have already been put into place. The African Union has an architecture on compliance and accountability issues, for example, which was one of the sticking points. It's been one of the sticking points over the years. And so I believe that both entities have learned, and with those lessons learned, we'll be able to have more effective and efficient peace operations that are run by the African Union.
Thanks, Linda. I really agree with that point that you made around accountability and compliance at the African Union being super important, especially when we think about procedures to protect civilians and avoid any human rights harms. I wonder, how would you assess the AU's ability to actually implement these policies in practice?
Who are those deployed into UN peace support operations? The majority of persons who are in UN peace operations, at least on the continent, happens to be Africans. So admittedly, the African Union at the initial stages of its engagement had some challenges because it didn't have its own policies in place. But more importantly, and a point that we need to take into account, is that the African Union was doing something that basically multilateral institutions had not been doing. The UN goes in when war has ended, basically. So it is much more easier to do peacekeeping and limit the consequences, the inadvertent consequences of, you know, violence. The African Union deploys into active conflict situations. In these situations, and David mentioned this, the nature of warfare has changed. And so without a blueprint and without a template, this was quite challenging in the earlier stages of the AU's peacekeeping operations. But the AU has since learned. If you go to Somalia, for example, a whole architecture was put into place to help address, because the AU recognizes that its missions in volatile situations are bound to have casualties. And so what it did was to put in place an architecture not only to minimize these casualties, but also to have remedial actions when these casualties occur. It's not perfect, but I will have to say that in terms of implementing their own policies as well as the UN's policies, the AU has come a long, long way. The African Union itself also has training. It works a lot now with the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent to make sure that national armed forces are also receiving adequate practical training beyond, you know, the laws, the practical training on how to protect civilians. But we know that the protection of civilians is not just hinged on one pillar, which is the physical protection. And so there is also a lot of effort in engagement, the political angle, to ensure that all facets of the protection spectrum are effectively addressed.
So, David, we just heard from Linda about how the United Nations and the African Union are working together in light of UN Security Council Resolution 2719. But, of course, this is not the first time these institutions have been collaborating. So, from your institutional perspective, would you be able to tell us a little bit about how this collaboration has been evolving?
There's been an active level of collaboration between the AU and the UN going back many years. There have been cases where, as Linda mentioned, the two organizations have been deployed jointly in the hybrid operation Darfur. There have been cases where the UN has come in after an AU deployment. And there have been cases where the AU has been in the lead on the political mediation side, while the UN has been deployed on the ground. So there's been a lot of opportunities, let's say, to learn from experience. I think what the resolution 2719 does is try to put some systematic order underpinned by, as Linda was saying, financial predictability and sustainability. And that represents a big opportunity. It's an opportunity which the UN Secretary General has been calling for a long time. And in fact, in his new agenda for peace, he had already called for, once again, sustainable financing for African Union peace operations. And as it happens, then a few months later, last December 2023, after his new agenda for peace came out, finally, the Security Council agreed to it. So it's an important step forward. I think another point that Linda made is important, and she talked about the need for the organizations to trust each other. One thing that strikes me about the resolution is how it really demands both organizations to make a quantum leap in the kind of interaction. So yes, we've had lots of different ad hoc experiences. We do joint trainings at times. We've been deployed together at times. But this actually this resolution is interesting because it doesn't just say, you know, provide financing on a case-by-case basis. It lays out that from the very early stages, consultations on a strategic assessment should happen jointly. A range of options should be put forward to the African Union Peace and Security Council and the UN Security Council. A draft concept of operations developed by the AU, but in collaboration with the UN. And so from the very early conceptual and planning stages, it requires a level of jointness. And then it goes on to talk about further engagements, including coherent political strategy, the need for detailed planning documents following the concept of operations, work together on things like human rights due diligence, making sure that operations minimize any negative human rights impacts, options for the logistical support of such an operation, and what those mission models might entail, and other, a big open word, logistical, financial, and other support through the UN-assessed contributions. And that certainly could entail training and other things.
Thanks, David. Could you tell us a bit more about what this collaboration will look like in practice? What do the UN and the AU need to do to make this happen?
Two things about that. One is, as I said, means that we as the UN Secretariat and the AU need to think carefully about what that entails in practice and begin to think through what might be a basic planning, for example, timeline and step of actions, a kind of, you know, logical framework through which we would work through this, at least so we have a common basis of understanding. And that work is ongoing. Colleagues in the UN Secretariat and the AU are thinking through these steps. But I think the AU will need to probably to raise its readiness to engage, and the UN will need to I think through carefully how to be a good partner and an easily accessible partner. Point one. Point two, I wouldn't underestimate how easy it is to write some of this down and how hard it is for two political organizations with the best will in the world to accomplish this. So we're talking about an early assessment and a joint assessment that may be quite early in a conflict state. And as we know from both the experience of the AU and the experience of the UN, how difficult it can be to get political consensus at the highest table to actually understand a conflict in the same way, to begin to engage when perhaps the host governments involved in that conflict are saying, you know, based on sovereignty, that there shouldn't be any such joint assessment coming in. So I just want to bear in mind that these are two political organizations ultimately, and you're now raising the bar because you need political consensus to work in both context and then to come together. So we're going to have to work very carefully as Secretariat and the AU Commission to make sure that is something that our member states can come together on.
So David, as you mentioned, African-led peace enforcement missions featured as a central ask in the new agenda for peace policy brief. Now, some have argued that the UN Secretary General rhetorically elevating this concept of peace enforcement, which involves the use of force against combatants, to pretty much the same level as UN peacekeeping, which is really intended to preserve an existing peace, creates a problem. There was some concern with this shift. So what do you think this means for the future of the United Nations?
I think that there's been a lot of discussion over the last few months of 2023 after the precipitous withdrawal of MINUSMA that sort of equated focus on peace enforcement and new agenda for peace, closure of mission in Mali equals end of peacekeeping, new tool, peace enforcement. I think that's the wrong conclusion. I think that what the Secretary General was trying to do was to make it very clear that peacekeeping shouldn't be the tool that the Security Council uses in situations where peace enforcement is required. And one should remember that Mali, the mission in Mali, the UN peacekeeping mission, MINUSMA, was the third mission to leave. There were peace enforcement missions in Mali. And in fact, one of the senior leadership of the UN team that left Mali was mentioning in her debriefing discussion that MINUSMA, the mission, was part of a three-legged stool that included the multinational force that was there. You had French-led multinational force operations, and there's also G5 Sahel in the mix as well. And in a way, the last mission to leave, MINUSMA, was then a one-legged stool, and it fell. And it fell in it as much because of geopolitical shifts as it did because of the operational challenges. But I think the Secretary General was quite taken aback by the number of casualties, the number of people sacrificed in that mission in a context which was not peacekeeping, but peace enforcement. And that peace enforcement task with one mission remaining being impossible. So I think the focus was really on saying, where's the boundary between peacekeeping and peace enforcement, rather than saying, you know, never peacekeeping, only peace enforcement. And so I think that's the way to read the new agenda for peace. It actually includes a couple of paragraphs on the importance of strengthening the peacekeeping tool. And I think that it's very likely that we will continue to see different demands for UN peacekeeping because of a number of things, the ability to draw on a wide range of countries, which brings sustainability, it brings legitimacy, the ability to bring together a multidimensional approach, and the ability also to link in an integrated way across the UN system. So I don't see it as an either or. At the same time, when peacekeeping is not the right tool, we need to be very clear that we are able to use, and the Council has always had the ability to call on peace enforcement.
So we've just heard from David about the dilemmas that the UN is facing with the concept of peace enforcement. Linda, do you see similar discussions happening at the AU level? What do you feel like this shift in the new agenda for peace around focusing on peace enforcement means for African-led peace operations?
Again, I have to agree with David. I did not read the Secretary General's call for peace enforcement action as a replacement for peacekeeping. Rather, I see it as amplifying what many other reports have pointed out. And what we see the Secretary General doing is being much more pragmatic and realistic. So in the past, we have had peacekeeping operations trying to address challenges that peacekeeping operations were not designed to address. In the case of Mali, for example, and with MINUSMA, part of the challenge that the mission had was that it had a mandate that was ill-suited to the context. And because of that, the civilians always had challenges with MINUSMA. At the very outset, they were very happy to receive the mission. But then, as we all know, as time progressed, they became more and more frustrated with the mission. And so what the new agenda for peace seeks to do is to get the United Nations itself, but I think also the allied institutions, the continental and regional bodies, to be more realistic. And for the United Nations to be able to say that we are unable to address this, how do we work with our partners to be able to find a workable and a durable solution. In that same agenda, there is a lot of emphasis on prevention. There is also a lot of emphasis on the primacy of politics. And so I think it needs to be taken, you know, in its totality and not taking out of that context.
Thanks, Linda. I actually really agree with that take there. Certainly the point around the UN being more realistic, I think that's something we could all agree with. But turning back to you, David, I want to ask you about the concept of peace enforcement again. It does have a very poor track record of success, and Safer World and many others have pointed this out in our research. Now, for the UN, is this shift to peace enforcement uncomfortable, or is this just the reality of engaging in complex conflict environments?
I think that the starting change is the politics of it. And there I agree with Linda. It's better to be realistic and not just throw a multidimensional peace operation into a situation where you don't have those conditions, right? Where it's on paper, it's being asked to accompany a political process, support peace building, and provide, you know, a basic level of security and confidence, when actually there are well-armed, funded, internationally potentially or regionally supported actors whose aim it is to use violence to thwart just that outcome. Then you've got to do something about that one way or the other. And that's where I think we're having difficulty or we've seen difficulty in peacekeeping. I wouldn't then assume that the only problem is that we took out a screwdriver, peacekeeping, when we should have taken out a hammer, peace enforcement, and we just chose the wrong tool. I think the stakes and the challenges go up exponentially when precisely you have one party that is not ready to see the same political outcome as the others. And the prime example of that is, of course, Afghanistan. You will never have a more powerful peace enforcement operation with more money put into peace building, et cetera, for all the, you know, mistakes or analysis that you might make of it. The real problem was that there was a well-funded actor with, you know, levels of international support that was committed to another outcome, and that was the Taliban. So I think that's where we have to be a little bit conscious that this is difficult and we can look at our own tools, but ultimately it will be won and lost by definition in peace enforcement on a battlefield unless you can bring the parties to the political table and reach peace. And that's where the whole question of a political process is really key. The New Agenda for Peace makes that point. Linda made that point. We need to find a way to accompany peace enforcement efforts with a political process. But that's where, if you have a divided international community, the parties will always find it, you know, easier to get support for a divisive position rather than being pushed towards uniting for a compromised peaceful outcome.
Thanks, David. The New Agenda for Peace is just one input into the wider deliberations related to the Summit of the Future, which we know will take place in September 2024. So, Linda, with this forward-looking mindset, what does the future of peacekeeping hold?
Now, one of the things that we need to look at coming from the African continent is the geopolitics and how that is panning out on the continent. So we are seeing a lot of challenges, without mentioning names, with certain member states and their influence in some of these countries where we are having major challenges. The challenge is that our security is so interlinked that whatever happens to one African country cascades into the others. And so it's important for us to be able to reflect and come up with innovative ways of supporting the African Union, but also the other regional bodies that make up the African Union, so that we are able to assist our member states weave their way out of some of the challenges that they find themselves in.
Okay, now over to you, David. How do you see the future of peacekeeping, and what would you like to see done differently?
Well, I think it's difficult to predict the future of peacekeeping. There have been a number of times in the past where people have predicted that peacekeeping would be over, let's say. I think that that's unlikely to be the case. where I think we need to be ready is that from the UN perspective is to make sure that peace operations continue to be a viable part of a range of tools which the UN can bring in a nimble and agile way, and that we can draw on capabilities that the UN possesses that no single actor possesses, but perhaps use them in new and innovative ways, sometimes working with partners such as the AU, sometimes, as I mentioned, for example, in the case of Haiti, where Kenya is going to lead an operation, finding ways where our training and our capability support tools might be used in that context. I think that we'll continue to be in this sort of difficult geopolitical environment. So it'll be important to maintain the kind of capabilities we've built up at the UN, and be ready to use them in new contexts. Effective partnership doesn't necessarily equate to outsourcing. It's about finding the right mix of tools and capabilities for a given situation where each entity brings strengths to the table, and the UN can play its own unique and complementary role. I think there are a number of capabilities which we need to continue to strengthen and maybe build. For example, climate and security is an emerging area, understanding how the effects of climate change might drive conflict. I mentioned earlier digital challenges in the digital sphere, but certainly mis and disinformation and how operations can deal deal with this when they're being targeted by mis and disinformation. I think dealing also with the regional implications of conflict, a lot of the drivers of conflict are actually regional, and the mandates of our missions are very often bounded within the borders of a country. So if you look at our mission in the Eastern DRC, for example, we've accompanied since the beginning of the peacekeeping operation, you know, a new constitution, the election of a president, Kabila twice, the election of an opposition president twice. There's a transition which has happened. What we're doing in the Eastern DRC is trying to maintain a level of protection and help the government extend its authority amidst what doesn't speak its name, but is a regional conflict driven by resource, inter-ethnic and regional power imbalances. So how do we ensure that those drivers of conflict are addressed to help to resolve some of these conflict situations? And that will probably require, again, a mix of organizations, agencies to do so. So I think those will be some of the challenges that we'll need to address in the future.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Linda. And thanks once again to Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs for speaking to us. So, Jordan, what are your key takeaways from that discussion?
Well, I thought it was a really great discussion. The key thing for me is that it's clear that the future of peacekeeping has not really been decided yet. We know that 2023 was a really eventful year for UN peace operations and did lay some groundwork for decisions to be made in 2024. Now, you know, we saw multiple peacekeeping operations close down. We saw the quite revolutionary UN Security Council resolution on AU financing, actually. And then we saw this new Agenda for Peace framework that really sets the scene for the summit of the future. And I think our guests today really reflected on these shifting sands and shared some of the progress that's being made between the AU and the UN and some of the lessons that need to be learned from. And I think really that sets the scene for thinking about the future of peacekeeping this year and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really fascinating and full of so much great content. But one of the comments that really stuck in my mind came from Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs right at the start, where she mentioned that military solutions don't achieve political objectives. And I think for me, that's something really important to bear in mind in all of this. Another interesting point for me was something that David started to bring in at the end, where he talked about climate change as a driver of conflict, but also the role of misinformation and disinformation and how peace operations are supposed to deal with this. He also talked about the regional implications of conflict and the complexity with all the different number of actors involved in conflicts these days. Now, obviously these issues do not only affect institutions like the UN and the AU, but they're obviously going to have a really big impact on the future of peacekeeping moving forwards. And I think in the mix of all of this, it's important to think back to a point that actually both David and Linda made in the discussion, which is this idea that both ideas are consensus-based. And what we're seeing is this struggle to achieve consensus at the UN Security Council and in other parts of the UN, sometimes even within the UN. And that's really going to affect the future of peacekeeping, since it fundamentally relies on that basis. And so all of these other cross-cutting factors that we've discussed over the course of the episode mean that consensus is becoming harder and harder to achieve. So I think that's a real challenge for the UN and the AU moving forwards.
And Charlie, maybe another thing to think about with consensus is that, you know, looking back at the past, peacekeeping didn't always exist. And so it's not a guarantee that it's going to exist in the future. So if consensus is making it harder and harder, there are some serious questions and existential questions about the future of peacekeeping. Now, here's where the idea of peace enforcement kind of comes into things, because I think our guest spoke about the implications of peace enforcement, but I think there's still some questions to be answered about what this actually means for the UN. Some of us have, I've argued at length that this is a really fundamentally challenging concept to come into UN peace operations and work with peacekeeping doctrine. And so we need to think about how the UN's going to do this and maintain its principles of impartiality. And I don't think we're there yet in terms of answering that big question. The other thing I just, though, want to go back to is when we're thinking about consensus, we do need to think about, do key member states still support UN peacekeeping? And we heard from Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs at the beginning that she, in her legislative role in the United States Congress, still sees UN peacekeeping as this highly relevant tool for conflict prevention. So as long as we have the major donors of the UN system and the major political players behind UN peacekeeping, then there is going to be a future, or some sort of future, for this mode of conflict prevention moving forward. The summit of the future obviously is going to be a space where some of these deliberations and decisions are made, but it's not going to be the only space. And so it's likely over the next few years, we'll see how that evolves and whether the concept of peace enforcement becomes synonymous with peacekeeping, or whether peacekeeping is carved out as a niche in itself.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And it really just feels like all eyes will be on the UN and the AU for the rest of 2024 and even beyond that, as we work towards understanding the future of peacekeeping in this context. But that's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening.
WarPod from Safer World. This series was produced by Andy O'Connor and supported by the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust. You can listen to all previous episodes and catch up on the latest releases wherever you get your podcasts by searching for and following WarPod. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at war_pod and at SaferWorld. And to find out more about our work, visit saferworld-global.org.